Daily News viewer vote. Military spokesman for Yemen's Houthi movement said in a tweet on Saturday it had targeted the Jisan and Abda airports, as well as a military base in Saudi Arabia, with drones. The hit was accurate, the spokesman said on Twitter. Earlier on Saturday and Friday, the Saudi coalition had said it had intercepted and destroyed three explosive-laden drones from Houthis aimed towards Saudi Arabia, without specifying the location. President Alpha Conde of Guinea won the October 18th election with 59.5% of the vote, according to a full preliminary tally from the Election Commission on Saturday. The victory requires confirmation by the Constitutional Court. It gives a third term in office to the 82-year-old Conde after a bitterly fought election in which the opposition said he had no right to participate. Conde says a constitutional referendum in March reset his two-year limit, but opponents say he's breaking the law by holding onto power. Results were announced in batches in recent days and already showed Conde in the lead, which sparked street protests and opposition strongholds in which at least 17 people died. And in the Ivory Coast, President Alassane Ouattara is also running for a third term in elections this month, after using a change in the constitution as a reset, sparking violent clashes in recent days in the streets of that country as well. U.S. President Donald Trump voted in his adopted home state of Florida before hitting the campaign trail for rallies in three swing states Saturday, joining more than 54 million Americans who have cast early ballots ahead of the November 3rd presidential election. Trump voted at a library in West Palm Beach near his Mar-a-Lago estate, after switching his permanent residence and voter registration last year from New York to Florida. This is VOA News. Iran's foreign ministry on Saturday described a U.S.-brokered Sudan-Israel deal to normalize ties as phony and accused Khartoum of paying a ransom in return for Washington removing it from a list of state sponsors of terrorism. Iran remains on that list. The deal agreed to on Friday marked the third Arab government after the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain to set aside hostilities with Israel in the last 2 months. U.S. President Donald Trump announced on Monday he would take Sudan off the list once it had deposited $335 million it had pledged to pay in victims' compensation. Khartoum has since placed the funds in a special escrow account for victims of al-Qaeda attacks on U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. And Poland's President Andrzej Duda has tested positive for the coronavirus, according to a spokesman. The spokesman said Saturday on Twitter that the 48-year-old conservative leader was tested the day before and his result was positive. He added that the president feels well. Duda's diagnosis came amid a huge surge in the number of confirmed coronavirus cases and deaths in Poland. North Korea has warned its citizens to stay indoors, saying seasonal yellow dust blowing in from China might carry the new coronavirus into the country. The claim that the virus that causes COVID-19 could spread to North Korea from the Gobi Desert, which is 1,200 miles away, appears to be unsupported. 6 feet is a common social distancing metric, although the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says droplets containing the virus can sometimes linger in the air for hours. A report in a North Korean newspaper said citizens should refrain from outdoor activities and must follow prevention guidelines, such as wearing masks when they go outside. And more reaction on that deal to normalize ties between Sudan and Israel. The United Arab Emirates, which signed a normalization deal with Israel in September, welcomed Sudan's decision to establish relations too as historic. Sudan's decision to initiate relations with the State of Israel is an important step to enhance security and prosperity in the region, the official WAM news agency said, citing the foreign ministry. And Bahrain, which followed the UAE in striking a normalization deal with Israel, hailed the agreement as well between Sudan and Israel. It underlined the kingdom's support for Sudan's efforts to exercise an active and constructive role in the international community. That's according to a foreign ministry statement. For more on these and other international stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
It is Alpha Condé who is determined in his logic of power control, using the force and means of the state to undermine democracy and violate human rights.
Guinean civil society and opposition groups reject the outcome of the recent presidential election.
It is not in our laws, and the president should be aware. And if he's not aware, he should be made to be aware. And that is why agitators for restructuring are clamoring that states should be empowered through an amendment of the constitution to allow governors to control their state police.
The Nigerian main opposition party says President Muhammadu Buhari's recent address to the nation regarding the youth protest shows he is out of touch with the current situation on the ground.
The chairman of one party both support Magufuli openly, different party, and the minister remains silent. While we will support another party, the minister becomes furious. We cannot understand that, and it is just ridiculous.
And a Tanzanian presidential candidate warns his supporters will take to the streets in protest if there's manipulation of the election results in Zanzibar next week. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Civil society groups and government opponents say they will not accept the results of the recent election in which incumbent President Alpha Conde is seeking re-election. The groups say the presidential poll was fraught with irregularities and rigging. They cited instances of ballot stuffing while accusing the electoral body of organizing an election that was neither transparent nor credible. This after preliminary results show that President Alpha Conde is on course to win re-election. His supporters say an official declaration of his electoral victory will validate the amendment of the constitution, which paves the way for the president to seek a third term. Opponents who boycotted the recent election say the president's re-election bid violates the tenet of democracy and is an affront to the people of Guinea. For the latest development and analysis of the political situation in the country, I reach for Romo Frederick Lua, an attorney and a prominent human rights defender in Guinea.
Yes, indeed, Alpha Conde is on the verge of winning this election for a third term, according to the results that the National Electoral Commission is giving to the account. At the same time, the main opponent, Selu Dale, who is claiming victory in these same elections. What is obvious is that the elections were not fair and transparent. There were ballot box stuffing, and the minutes were falsified or confiscated. Evidence of this stuffing is currently circulating on social networks. Opposition representatives were refused to give copies of these minutes after the counting of votes in some polling stations. The Constitutional Court even issued a ruling asking the Electoral Commission to make these minutes available to the opposition representatives. It is clear that the people of Guinea are calling for an alternation of power. And if these elections are not transparent and credible, Guinea risks renewed instability that will further exacerbate the already critical level of poverty.
Some of the political parties who boycotted the election say that they are vindicated because they knew, as they said, that the elections were neither going to be free, fair, credible, or transparent. Do you think they are vindicated by refusing to participate in this election?
Look, since Alpha Conde has been in power 10 years ago, we have never had a transparent election. You know, before this election, he proceeded in an incredible way to change the constitution in the context of a bloody protest. This election
were for the opposition a dilemma intentionally created. Either boycott the election, which Alpha Condé was looking for, since without a strong opponent, he would quickly win the election, or go to the election knowing that Alpha Condé controls the process from the beginning to end. So, Selu Dale chose the second option while betting on Alpha's unpopularity. I think that the opposition that did not participate in this election may want to justify its attitude in view of the evolution of the situation. But for me, the opposition will do better to silence now the divergences and joint effort so that the alternation is possible.
Frederick, there were reports of gunfire on Friday in Conakry as supporters of opposition presidential candidate Selu Dale Ndiallo clashed with police. Are fears that there could be more violence when the president is officially declared winner legitimate at all, looking at what is currently happening?
If the president is declared the winner of this election under the current condition, I think Guinea will return to instability that could worsen further and drag the country into chaos. To be convinced of this, a large part of the civil society under the umbrella of the FNDC has already announced that it will not recognize a possible victory of Alpha Condé in this election.
But Frederick, if the civil society groups say they will not accept the outcome of the election, what is it that is going to stop the incumbent president from being officially installed?
The opposition and civil society organization have only the legal means to oppose the seizure of power by Alpha Condé, including demonstration and other social movement. It is Alpha Condé who is determined in his logic of power control, using the force and means of the state to undermine democracy and violate human rights. This is why the involvement of the international community in the management of Guinean crisis is more than desired to bring Guinea back on the path of democracy and the rule of law.
For Lomo, Frederick Loa is an attorney and a prominent human rights defender. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari addressed the nation late Thursday in response to weeks of protests calling for greater youth inclusion in Nigerian politics and an end to police brutality. The president urged young Nigerians to stay out of trouble, but critics say his address lacked compassion and failed to highlight vital issues that are driving the demonstrations. For VOA, Timothy Obiazu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The president's televised address came after nearly 2 weeks of widespread protests by thousands of youths in Nigeria. But the broadcast, which lasted about 12 minutes, has been widely criticized by citizens and human rights activists who say it lacked empathy and did not address the shooting of protesters at the Lekki toll gate in Lagos on Tuesday. Human rights activist Aisha Yusufu has been part of the protests.
It just shows you the kind of person that the president is and the kind of government that he's running, and the reason why they never listen to the yearnings of the people. He seemed not to care. That's why he would do a speech and would not even mention the people that were killed. He would not even mention their families.
The protests to halt police brutality in Africa's most populous nation started out quickly and expanded to include a growing demand by Nigeria's younger citizens for better governance and inclusion in Nigerian politics. But during his broadcast, President Muhammadu Buhari said protesters may have misinterpreted his government's swift response to ban the SARS police unit as an avenue to make more demands and cause disruptions.
Sadly, the promptness with which we have acted seemed to have been misconstrued as a sign of weakness and twisted by some for their selfish, unpatriotic interests.
Nigeria's politics has been dominated by the country's older population, despite the country having a large youth population. More than 70% of Nigerians are below the age of 40. Political analyst Ezenwa Nwagu says many issues raised by protesters can only be fixed when Nigerians exercise their rights by voting during elections.
You don't get political change from protests. In a democracy, you can address a reform issue. Do you understand what I'm saying? But once you start saying bad governance, that is an election matter. When election comes, you say this government is bad, and you present an alternative, and people can vote. 90% of the people who you see in the protest have no voter's card. They are not members of any political party.
An escalation in violence during the recent protests has led to bans and curfews. But despite the president's warning for citizens to stay out of trouble, protesters will press ahead for the time being, says Aisha.
So people are used to hearing the president, of course, saying something and not doing it. And so his words doesn't mean anything. His words are not his bond. And so the protesters, this was the reason why they kept saying that they will continue on this. They want to see action. They don't want mere words, mere rhetorics. No, they want to see the action on ground.
President Buhari, a former military head of state, was elected in 2015 at the age of 72 and re-elected to a second term last year. Nigerians pushing to have a younger or simply different representative in the nation's highest political office will have to wait until the next general election set for 2023. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Meanwhile, Nigeria's main opposition party, the People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says President Muhammadu Buhari did not address the concerns of protesters who demand justice and the end of police brutality. Kola Ologbodiyan, spokesperson for the PDP, says failure to address the concerns of the youth is unlikely to resolve the tension and violence in parts of the country. Kola Ologbodiyan tells me that the president's address to Nigerians showed that he was not in touch with the current prevailing conditions on the ground.
Well, for us in the People's Democratic Party, we considered Mr. President's address of last night as very depressing, and it does not address the concerns being raised by Nigerians. As a matter of fact, it doesn't portray Mr. President as an in-charge president who is in tune with the reality of our society as we speak today as a country. And for us in the Liberal Democratic Party, our expectation was that Mr. President would touch on the issues bordering on insecurity, particularly the hoodlum involvement in peaceful protests. We expected Mr. President to set up an inquiry into the deployment of the military against peaceful protesters. We expect Mr. President to address issues about the killing that has occurred across the country. But nothing from Mr. President was raised on these issues.
Bakola, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that the president expressed empathy and that his call for calm is just the first step in an effort to ensure that the country remains peaceful in spite of what is going on at the moment?
Mr. President did not show any empathy. How do you explain a situation where the military opened fire on unarmed protesters? The last time that was witnessed in this country was in 1993 when Nigerians were protesting in Lagos against the annulment of the June 12th election, which was presumably won by Moshood Abiola. That was when we witnessed the opening of fire against unarmed protesters. And it has happened in 2020 under President Muhammadu Buhari. It is unfortunate. There was no empathy of any sort from Mr. President. And Mr. President refused, and bluntly too, to address the issues that Nigerians had raised that led to the protests that consequently created the room for hoodlums to hijack the protest.
Kola, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that the president was right in calling on local government to find a solution to the violence in their respective state. You described hoodlums taking advantage of the protest to cause mayhem, to destroy property, and that the call from the president was in good taste to ensure the country's territorial integrity, peace, and stability is maintained.
That is an indication, or it supports the assertion of the People's Democratic Party, that Mr. President is not in tune with reality of the situation in which we have found ourselves in this country under his watch. It is clear and manifestly so that the governors of the respective states and the chairmen of our local of the 774 local governments have no powers under our law to command troops. President Muhammadu Buhari is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. How can a governor that does not have the power to control troops or to command troops or command a commissioner of police that has been posted to his state from Abuja now give orders to the military or the police or even the prison warden? It is not in our laws, and the president should be aware. And if he's not aware, he should be made to be aware. And that is why agitators for restructuring are clamoring that states should be empowered through an amendment of the Constitution to allow governors to control their state police. And possibly, as it is done in the United States of America, even council chairmen should be able to have council police who will take charge of the community responsibilities bordering on security. We don't have that in Nigeria. It is therefore strange to reasoning that Mr. President will direct governors to take charge of the security of their state. With what? With their hand?
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The Electoral Commission of Ghana says the presidential candidate of the opposition Liberal Party has qualified to contest in the upcoming December 7 general election. Kofi Akpaloo joins 11 other presidential candidates, including incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo from the governing New Patriotic Party, or NPP, and former President John Dramani Mahama from the main opposition party National Democratic Congress, or NDC. The December election will be Mr. Akpaloo's first attempt at wrestling power from an incumbent president. Analysts, however, downplay his electoral prospects, saying the country is sharply divided between the two dominant parties, the NPP and the NDC. They contend that the small number of swing voters might not be enough for him to win the presidency. But Mr. Kofi Akpaloo, presidential candidate for the opposition Liberal Party, tells me that Ghanaians are disappointed in both the NPP and the NDC. He says voters are ready to make him the West African country's next president.
What we will do as a party is to put money directly into people's pocket. We're going to introduce and pay child benefits. Every child below 18 years will receive a monthly child benefit of 200 Ghana cedis. If you are lucky and you are a twin, then per child you will receive 300 cedis. We also going to pay unemployment benefit. If you lose your job, you're going to start receiving government support. That's income support and then also unemployment benefit, because we want to stimulate our economy to generate demand activities, to create jobs and to create wealth. This is a way of wealth transfer.
But how are you going to pay for this expensive policy that you are espousing to Ghanaians?
We need to create money locally. Our dependency on foreign aid and also foreign support, we need to minimize that. We need to start creating money locally to expand the economy. That economy has been too small for quite a long time now. It's time that we grow the economy, expand it, and create jobs and create wealth for all Ghanaians. So we're going to create the money. We're going to use what we call sovereign money to do those things.
So moving forward, how would you handle the issue of corruption? Because a lot of Ghanaians have been talking about public corruption. Specifically, what policies are you going to implement to combat that?
We will make sure those above 18 years will be compelled to file their annual tax returns. We believe that when you do that, everybody is going to declare pays for her income and asset and liabilities so that it will be easy for us to track people, assets, and stuff like that. We are also going to allocate a unique ID number to everybody living in Ghana, including the old children. We're also going to connect it to the home address because we have to build proper address system whereby the two will link together. We'll be able to track and trace people wherever they are. And this will help us. And also, public tender, we're going to make sure it's open, there's transparency. Businesses will make sure are done on time and also punish people who will do something untoward.
What do you think your realistic chances are? Because some Ghanaians that I spoke with are of the view that your candidacy might not necessarily break the foothold that the New Patriotic Party and the NDC, the main opposition party, have on the Ghanaian population, and that your candidacy, they argue, could be a waste of votes. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I will win the election. I will win this year's election because, you see, it's not a matter of making noise on the traditional airwaves or the traditional media. It's a matter of going to the people, selling your message to them gradually, and they buying into the message. We are proposing that we're going to pay them child benefit, unemployment benefit, and they are buying into the message. Then they know, yes. And even at all, some people are not even happy with this MPP and NDC dominance.
But do you think Ghanaians are ready for a third force to defeat the incumbent president Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo and main challenger, former president John Dramani Mahama?
We'll beat them all. We'll beat them all. We, in the LPG, we will beat everyone. We don't care about their previous election results. This is our first time we are contesting the presidency. So we will shock everybody. It's like what happened in France, where Macron just from nowhere won the elections, and Yaya Boni from nowhere won the Benin election when he contested as an independent candidate. This is what will happen here in Ghana. People are fed up with MPP and NDC, and I can tell you, we will win the elections. I, Kofi Apalu, will win the election, hands down.
Kofi Apalu is the presidential candidate for the opposition Liberal Party of Ghana. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. The United Nations warns of a looming health crisis in Sudan following historic floods which have created conditions for deadly insect-transmitted diseases to thrive. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Some 875,000 people across Sudan are affected by torrential rains and floods, which have caused widespread damage to homes, crops, and livelihoods. The floods have left behind stagnant water pools, which are perfect breeding grounds for mosquitoes. And the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs warns that more than 4.5 million people are at risk of mosquito-transmitted diseases, such as malaria, chikungunya, and viral hemorrhagic fevers, or VHF. Sudan's Federal Ministry of Health has already reported increasing numbers of suspected VHF cases, which include dengue, yellow fever, and Rift Valley fever. The agency reports 2,226 cases, most in northern state, including 56 deaths. Jens Laerke, a spokesman for the UN Humanitarian Affairs Office, says there also is an outbreak of chikungunya in West Darfur, where nearly 250 people have been diagnosed with this viral disease.
The worst disease and the most lethal disease is, in fact, malaria. There's over 1.1 million malaria cases as of the end of September this year across the country. And malaria has reached epidemic levels in 15 out of the 18 states in Sudan.
Laerke says UN aid agencies have procured hundreds of emergency health kits to support malaria treatment and other health needs. He says the kits can serve up to 2.7 million people for 3 months. However, he tells VOA, aid workers are having difficulty getting the supplies out into the field.
One of the things that the partners on the ground are actually mentioning, trying to get these emergency health kits out in the communities, and particularly among the many internally displaced people, there's almost 2 million internally displaced people in Sudan, is that the floods and the stagnant water is still hampering access to those people.
Laerke says there is a shortage of medical supplies and needs will increase as insect-driven diseases continue to spread throughout the country. He says the UN's operation is in financial difficulty as it only has received 19% of needed funding. He says aid agencies urgently need to raise an estimated $25 million to procure essential medicines and to support measures for vaccine-preventable vector and waterborne diseases. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Tanzania, the presidential candidate for the opposition ACT Wazalendo says the party's campaign ahead of next week's general election in Zanzibar is progressing well. Maalim Seif Sharif Hamad, however, warns that his supporters will peacefully protest the outcome of the election if there's rigging and voter irregularities. He also expressed concern that the government appears to be using state institutions, including the Register of Political Parties, to thwart the opposition campaign in the run-up to the election. The remarks come after the Registrar of Political Parties wrote a letter asking why Hamad appeared on the same podium of main opposition leader Tundu Lissu's presidential campaign. Hamad was recently barred from campaigning for a week after another opposition party accused him of violating electoral laws. Maalim Seif Sharif Hamad is the presidential candidate for ACT Wazalendo in the Zanzibar election. He tells me that he expects to win the poll by a significant margin.
Our campaign has been going on very, very well. There are very successful series of campaigns in different constituencies of Zanzibar and Pemba. And all our meetings were attended by thousands and thousands of people. And I feel that they understood us, they understood what we stand for, and if elected, what they should expect from us. So far, we're doing very well, very fine.
Why do you think Zanzibaris this time will vote for you? Because this is not your first time of contesting. You've contested many times, but you have not been successful. What is different this time?
Well, friend, it's that in all the elections since 1995, that I have contested, I have won the elections. But as you know, in Africa, we find the ruling party was not prepared to give up power. So they tried to use all maneuvers to remain in power. In the last election, in 2015, it was very clear, all observers, both external and internal observers, all observed that I had won the elections by a huge majority. And because the ruling party and the state could not change the figures. What they did was just to nullify the elections without their reason and against the constitution and the law of Zanzibar. So all the days and every year, my number of my votes is increasing, not decreasing. So it means that Zanzibaris have much confidence in me. So if the elections are free and fair, I will definitely beat the CCM candidate by a very, very large margin.
So how would you ensure that your victory is protected, since you just said that it appears that the powers that be prevent you from acceding to power, even though you have won the election decisively?
Well, different from the other years, all the years I've tried to stop my followers from going to streets. But this time I said very clear, if we win the elections, end of the conflict. We have the evidence that we've won the elections, and if people want to go to the streets, I will not stop them. So it is up to the government now to decide whether to accept the result of elections or to welcome violence in the country. But we urge our followers to have peaceful demonstrations. But we know that the state always will use excessive force. But people say that they are prepared for that.
You were recently on the same campaign platform with Tundu Lissu, the main opposition challenger in the mainland Tanzania, as well as Freeman Mbowe, the chairperson or the chairman of CHADEMA. You have been writing a letter of protest by the Registrar of Political Parties that what you did was illegal. How do you address such a concern?
The office of the Registrar of Political Parties, they are trained double standards, because it was very open and it was very clear in televisions throughout Tanzania that the chairman of NRA, or the chairman, Mr. Mrema, of one of these parties, KLP, are publicly in a meeting of CCM going to support Magufuli. But to my surprise, the Register of Political Parties has not acted against Mrema. Why should the Register of Political Parties act against me supporting academic candidature? So we find that in double standards, really. So it seems that the Register of Political Parties is for all other departments. They are always supporting CCM, and they will do anything they can to try to sabotage our campaigns.
So they have written a letter to you asking you why they should not take an action against you. Some of your supporters are saying, why would you do that, particularly when you have been barred for 1 week, and that authorities could take additional action against you that could undermine your effort to become the next president in Zanzibar. How do you address that?
I don't think that they have no powers to stop me from competing in elections. And according to the law, you find the Register of Political Parties cannot ban any political parties 1 year before elections. So they send us letters, we reply the letters, but they don't come back to us. I mean, as I said, that why a chairman of one party votes support Magufuli openly, different party, and the Register remains silent. While we will support another party, the Register becomes furious. We cannot understand that.
Maalim Seif Sharif Hamad is the presidential candidate for Tanzania's opposition party ACT Wazalendo in the Zanzibar election. He spoke with me from Zanzibar. In South Africa, citizens are expressing concern about escalating racial tensions in Bloemfontein. They are calling on the government to immediately ease tensions to prevent what they warn could be a civil war if not addressed. Their concerns follow media reports of a standoff between Afrikaner farmers and black supporters of the Opposition Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF. Police vans were strategically parked to separate the two groups who were standing on opposite sides of the road. The police also mounted a roadblock ahead of the entrance of the city to prevent potential violence and chaos. The farmers were found in possession of military weapons, including machine guns and grenades, in their confrontation with the EFF black supporters. On the other hand, the blacks also carried weapons, including AK-47s. To learn more about what led to the latest escalation of tensions, Irete Nyiko Maluleka, a senior research fellow at the University of Pretoria Center for the Advancement of Scholarship.
Well, the most immediate trigger to the latest incident was the killing, the brutal, I must add, brutal killing of a young white farm manager in the small town, farming town of Senegal, in the Orange Free State region of the country, the province, near the border with Lesotho. This young man was killed brutally in the night of the 1st of October. And there was a lot of anger from the farming community and the farming community took their anger a little too far, because they then demonstrated and stormed a court hearing and banned the police vehicle and threatened violence, which is why then the EFF also responded in the way that they did.
Why hasn't the government of South Africa, or for that matter, local government, been able to resolve this simmering tension that intermittently appears to raise its ugly head?
I think part of the reason they haven't been able to deal with it is that I am not always convinced that they understand its causes well, or even understand their own failure as governments to provide the necessary leadership and the necessary intervention that would have prevented us reaching this state of affairs 26 years into our democracy. So the reasons are too many to mention. The police are not very effective in South Africa. And I want to argue that killing and death has become part and parcel of the culture. More black people die than white people, by the way. But because white people are generally more shielded from it, when one or two of them die, it becomes bigger news, which is a pity, because it shouldn't matter the color of the person who has died. But above all, the policies that government has put in place to try and help us redress and transform and move on, whether it's in education or in economic policy, the affirmative action, BEE, all of these policies have either not been implemented or not been thought through very carefully. So they are all failing to help us.
Well, there are suggestions that if this is not addressed now or in the near future, this tension could degenerate into a bloody conflict where many more people will die as a result. What do you think the government should do immediately to address this?
Well, one of the things that needs to happen is implementation of policies. I mean, to begin with, if you have policies that you don't implement, you are as good as not having policies. So we are famous for beautiful policies, nice sounding policies, which are seldom ever implemented. Secondly, I think that the problem of inequality in the country needs to be addressed very, very urgently, because we are one of the most unequal countries in the world. And this inequality, by the way, is not merely between white and black, although it is largely between black and white, but it is also between black and black, because the small black middle class is far removed from the poor and marginalized working class of black people.
Now, do you think both local and the main government have the political will to resolve this once and for all? And is it resolvable anyway?
I think it is resolvable, but not overnight. Clearly, we have failed to resolve it in 26 years. And that tells you something about how difficult it might be to resolve it. I think it is possible to resolve it. I think that with leadership, if we can focus on reducing the levels of inequality in this country, if we can stop corruption, because a lot of money gets stolen, money that could be building schools and putting these two accused who are now facing murder charge, putting them into school early enough in their lives so that they have skills. It's those kinds of things that we need to begin to do. It's all of those things that government, I think, can do immediately. Government can stop the police from being brutal. Government can try and fix the education system. Government can implement the economic policies and make sure that it reduces the inequality gap.
Tinyeko Muleleka is a senior research fellow at the University of Pretoria Center for the Advancement of Scholarship. He spoke with me from the South African capital, Pretoria. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Mm-hmm.
Tugatagwe mwefano guno kosanyisa kukwati mpola tokuita kuyomba na olaba panga iweze nga kulize ani tetuka olwayo munange obanga gamba tife na yenga kukozechi
Well, I'm one of them kechos. anajishusha hata kama kosa sio lake. Wanaume hafai kukurupuka kosa kuwapiga wanawake. Uchebe wanaume kujiamini kuona pisi moja ya kuaminia. Usiwe kama almas anawazalisha na wakimbia. Bora uwe majei kambesha pete ya muoi aongei. Lulu kama kilele usogei dakika tisini mechi kali ukosei. Tutululu mwanamke akikuvulia na akikununia wela na doja. Ogopa sana akiumia na akikwambia we na doja. Wela mwanamke chozi
music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sally, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, old age does not announce itself. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.